So hello, everyone. So I'm Sona Kotar, and I came from the UK now. I'm from the University of Cambridge. I have been going to CIDR many, many times. I dare not say how many times. But I started going in 2010. And so I wanted to say a little bit about that and say a little bit about what I think you should do at CIDR. So a lot about the CIDR is going to be passed after we've done these lectures and stuff, is going to be about the research component. And I think CIDR is a great time to work on a bit of research that is outside from your normal, regular research. And you want to work on something else, because otherwise you might get conflicted with your own research project or something. So this is a moment or an opportunity to work on something else and expand what you can work on and the things you understand in the earth and such. At the same time, I would also say don't work on something that is too far out from your expertise, because you want to be able to contribute to your research group. And you don't want to feel like you don't know, you can't actually do anything with this topic. So think about research topics that have your interest, that you've always wanted to work on, and that you could contribute to. And so the next 2 weeks before we start these research projects, it's really important to like talk to different people, talk to your peers, and talk about your research. And think about like what questions could we answer if we combined our knowledge? Because those are the kind of research projects that will then start up in a week or two. The ideas for the research projects are going to come from you. So it'll be really important to talk to each other. The other thing that you're here to do is to make many friends. So you risk looking like, oh, this is not working, of course. You risk looking like this in a couple weeks. This anticipation. This is a couple of us at CIDR 2010. And there's Rita, who's here, and Ved, who's here. So you also risk coming back in 8 years and lecturing. Red button. Do you think it works without? Okay. So you risk being back here in 8 years with some of your fellow CIDR buddies and lecturing here. So Ved, who was actually in the same research group as I was with Barbara Romanowicz, who organized these CIDRs for a long time. This is why we went to these CIDRs in the first place. But he is a couple years ahead of me in seismology, and it makes him a great mentor. So he went through the postdoc stage and the job search stage a couple years ahead of me. And so it made him a great person to ask all these questions to about what to do. And then Rita is my buddy in geochemistry, and she's a great person for all of my geochemistry questions. So now I know people in different fields in different places who I'm not embarrassed to ask my questions to. So I recommend building your network here while you're at CIDR, and there'll be plenty of opportunity for that. So I'm going to give you the first lecture on seismology. And so I'm going to be focusing a bit here on the lens of seismology. So this is going to be seem a little bit monodisciplinary. And this lecture is for those of you who have questions about seismology. So I suggest that you ask your questions about seismology if you have them. So I've given a little bit of an overview of what I think different like flavors of seismology that are out there. So there are theoretical seismologists. They just enjoy the study of like wave propagation, how those work, building new methods to solve the wave equation, or building new methods to invert inversion methods in the wave equation. Then there's observational seismologists who work more with the data. There are source seismologists. They're interested in what the earthquake types are like and what the rupture dynamics are. And there are structural seismologists who are interested in what the waves travel through. Of course, none of these can work without each other, right? The observational seismologists need to know their theory, and the theory need to know what is interesting about their physics. As a source seismologist, you can't study the source without knowing what the waves are traveling through. And as a structural seismologist, you can't study a structure without knowing what the earthquake source is like. So all of these are interconnected in seismology. In structural seismologies, we have people who are looking at shallow structure, kilometers deep exploration, so they use synthetic sources. There's people who are looking at local and regional imaging. My lecture is going to be very biased to global seismology, of course. And I'm going to be mainly focusing on body waves, but we'll get there. So all of these seismologists are obsessed with waves. And so a little bit of a recap of wave characteristics. So here's a single frequency wave. And here you can see the wave kind of propagate to the right. And here you see one little particle just going up and down, while the peak of the wave is propagating to the right. This single particle stays in one place and has a motion. This wave has a period, which is the time for one cycle. It has a frequency, which is 1/period, or it's the number of wave cycles that we can like fit in a second. It has a wavelength, which is the velocity times the period, so that's the kind of spatial dimension of our wave cycle. And then it has what we call wave number, which is 1/wavelength, so that's the amount of waves that we can kind of fit within 1 meter. And so speed relates all of this, the wavelength and the frequency and the wave number and the period to each other, and is the summarizes how this wave propagates. So this all comes out of the wave equation. So I'm going to start with a little bit of equation stuff, and then we'll move into a bit more applied body wave seismology. So the wave equation is really Newton's second law. The acceleration, so the motions, are driven by the sum of forces happening on that particle. And so for the wave equation, it looks like this. So this is our acceleration of u, which is our displacement. Here's our density term. This is the stress tensor, and F here is the body forces. So this could be earthquakes, the main source of our deviations. Gravity doesn't not use very much, because it's really only the case for very long wavelength waves where a lot of volume gets displaced that they become very sensitive to gravity. For most of our high frequency studies, they're just not that sensitive to gravity displacements. And so you might wonder, okay, so there's density here, but my Newton's second law is mass times acceleration. So what is divided out here is the volume integration. So there was a volume integration here over density. There was a volume integration over my body forces. And then here there was a surface integral over the stress. So the stresses are surface forces. So there was a surface integral there that has been divided out. So each term had a volume integration divided out of this. There's also some a bit of notation here. So this little I here can actually represent a 1, a 2, and a 3. And so those are my Cartesian coordinates. So we're in a three-dimensional space. So if you see a letter like this in each separate term, it means it actually represents three equations with a 1, a 2, or a 3 here. If you see a letter like this in one term here, like the derivative here of the stresses, then it means it's a summation. So this is actually a sum of all these in the three dimensions, the stresses. And everything is also a function of space and time, obviously. So the x here is a vector in space, and t is a time. So if I actually write down this whole thing, the three equations, and the summation fill out, it looks like that. So this is a simplified, and I've dropped all the space and time terms here. Okay, so we're going to talk about this term a whole lot more, because this is actually the term that tells us how the wave propagates. So this is where, if I am a little particle in the Earth, if the particle next to me moves, how am I going to react like that to that? How is that going to deform me? So if you are sitting in a graduate student office, and the graduate student next to you is strained by their PhD, they're going to emit stress, and that is going to put strain on you. So how much strain that's going to put on you depends on your relationship with with your neighboring PhD student, or how closely packed your PhD office is. So a little bit of a seismology psychology. So this is the same here. That's what we're going to talk about here. And we're going to talk about constitutive relationships. So this is how the deformation is causing stresses, which then propagates the deformation, and how that propagates through a continuum medium. And that's a lot of our propagation of the seismic wave, because this force, for example, earthquake force, is very localized in space and time. That might be in one location. So if we're solving the wave equation in many places, we can cross out this term and just look at this part. So here's a simplified constitutive relationship that you might remember from your physics classes. And this is the Hooke's law of a string. So the force caused by this spring, and when you pull on it, increases with how far away you've pulled that. So it's an increasing force, and it linearly increases with the distance x there that you've pulled on it. And so that's a deformation, that's a resulting force. And the k here is the spring constant, which describes how quickly it increases. And so what we have in Earth is not much more difficult than that, except that it's for a 3D continuum medium. So the forces can be like in all directions, and the deformations can be in all directions. So we're going to have a look at the forces, which is going to be our 3D stress tensor. And we're going to look at our 3D deformation, which is our 3D strain tensor. So here's our 3D stress tensor. So there's a little cube here. And on each face of the cube, I can have three types of forces, one going out parallel to the normal of the face, and two forces that are kind of shear forces on this, the shear stresses. And we can summarize that in this tensor, where we have our normal, our three normal stresses on the diagonal and the shear stresses around here. So while this here, the coordinates are x, y, and z, here I've used 1, 2, and 3 as the coordinates. Our strain tensor is described by infinitesimal small deformations that are happening. So here I have my location at x0. And here I have a little bit of deformation here, and a small bit. And I can estimate how big that deformation is by the gradient times the distance away. So two force order, my deformation is the gradient times the distance. And we look at this component, this gradient component, as the strain tensor. That is the deformation that we're looking at. And it's dimensionless, right? It's meters over meters. So here's an example of du1 over dx1 is bigger than zero, then my displacement here goes to the right, and the displacement here goes to the right stronger because my gradient is positive. And so I'm having a volume change here, right? You see this getting stretched out. Now I have the delta u1, delta x2, which puts a positive change in this direction. And you can see I have a shear component on my block over here. So here they're both positive. So they're both being stretched and being sheared. So the strain tensor here is summarized also in as a 3D tensor. And so we have our, so we're only looking at the symmetric part here. So this is averaging out the symmetric part of the deformation. The anti-symmetric part is actually the rotation of a block, and that doesn't happen in the Earth, so we're ignoring that bit. So we're only looking at the symmetric parts here. And this on the diagonal is showing us the volume changes. So we could add that together. It's called the dilatation. We can add these three components together and get the dilatation. It's written by a theta here. Can also be written by the strain ii. So the ii is a summation notation here again. For the ii, you can fill in ones or twos or threes. So epsilon 1, 1 plus epsilon 2, 2 plus epsilon 3, 3. So here is then my Hooke's law for a 3D continuum medium. So I have my stress tensor that we introduced, the strain tensor that I introduced, and here are our constants that relate the stress tensor to the strain tensor. And so we're assuming everything is linearly deforming and elastic. And that's fine for seismic waves. Seismic waves propagate, but mostly elastic, through the Earth. Our geodynamicist will be talking about deformation much longer timescales when the Earth is not behaving elastic. But on our timescales and for all small deformations, it's mainly elastic. And so we have these nine strain components, we have these nine stress components, and so to relate one to the other, we have 81 elastic constants relating them. Luckily, nature helps us out a bit. There's lots of symmetries here that a material has. So there's lots of these are going to be the same. And in the end, we only need 21 components to fully describe the relationship between the stress and the strain in a contained medium. Yeah?
How do you know them, the elastic constants? How do you calculate them? And how do you know them?
How do you calculate them? How do you observe them? Yeah, so we will be talking, for seismology, we'll be talking how we can observe them in the Earth. Although in seismology, we're mostly sensitive to observing seismic velocity, which is always modally divided by density. For mineral physicists, you want to do experiments to observe these modally in a lab and know how our material behaves in different directions. Does that make sense? Does that? Yeah. So, but observing 21 different components is different. It's difficult in a lab. It's difficult in elastic or in calculation, first principle calculations, and I would say it's impossible for seismologists.
How do you define the components to start with?
So how do you define the components to start with? Here I've assumed that we're looking at principal stress directions. Yeah, I haven't really gone into the rotations. But you can solve the equations into any Cartesian, or you can do it in spherical coordinates, which is a bit messy.
And then, how can you...
I can repeat it if you...
How can you relate that to natural things?
How can you relate that to natural things?
Natural observations.
Oh, to actually seismic observations. Well, I'll be showing you examples later of actual waves and what we can maybe say about that.
Okay, boss.
Any other questions? Yeah, so these are mostly what we're interested in the Earth, because that can tell us actually about composition, about presence of melt, about heterogeneity, all of that. But I'm going to simplify it even further. As I said, as a seismologist, you're not going to find out the 21 elastic components in the Earth. So for this lecture, I'm going to assume that the Earth is an isotropic medium. And for an isotropic medium, we can boil it down to only two constants, lambda here and mu. And so here's again, so we call these the Lemay constants. This delta is a Kronecker delta. It is 1 if I equals j. So now, and here you see the theta, which was the dilatation that I showed before. It was the sum of the diagonal of the strain tensor. So if I write this out, you see that the lambda, it turns up on the diagonal. It is sensitive to the volume change. And this mu turns up everywhere else. So what are these two constants? The mu is the shear modulus. So it tells you how a material likes to be sheared or likes not to be sheared, shearing this little block here. And lambda relates to the bulk modulus. And these two combined, the bulk modulus describes how a material changes volume or doesn't like to change volume. And so in mineral physicists often call the shear modulus a G. And the bulk model is a capital K. And seismologists use kappa and mu, just to confuse you. The Earth is not totally elastic. There is an anelastic part. The Earth is not totally isotropic. There is an anisotropic part. And so the next lecture, Maureen will tell you about all the lies I have in my lecture. So going back to the wave equation, so now we have a relationship between our stresses and the strain for an isotropic medium. We fill that in, we ignore any body forces, we use this vector relationship, which you guys all remember, and we get to the seismic wave equation for an isotropic medium that we filled in there. And so you see our lambdas and mu's pop in here. Just in case you don't remember all these vector things you can do with vectors. So we have the gradient term here. This is this upside down triangle. This describes, well, the gradient of a field everywhere. So the topography on the field, as you see here. The upside down triangle with a dot, this is the divergence or the, and it describes, it gives you a scalar because it's a sum, and it gives you the volume change in a particular location. So you look at the changes in all directions and add them together. This upside down triangle with a cross is the curl of a vector, and it gives you a new vector which shows, in this case, the displacement. So it shows the displacements that are orthogonal. So this would, if we have a little block, this would show us the shearing that is happening in the block. So this is our wave equation for an isotropic medium. And this is a solvable problem. So we're really lucky in seismology. We have a basic equation that we can build a mesh and we can actually solve the wave equation going through. I don't know if this is a movie. It is a movie. But Ibro Bozdak will be covering this in lecture 4. So she will be talking about how to forward model waves and how to solve this wave equation and different codes that are out there to do that kind of thing. So what comes out of the wave equation? Well, two types of waves are body waves. And so these are the waves that are propagating in 3D through the Earth. And the two types are the P wave. For the P wave, the displacement of the wave is parallel to the direction of propagation. And this is giving us volume changes. So you can see this little block here in the center. As it goes through, it's changing the volume of that block. And so that wave is going to be sensitive to our kappa and our mu. The shear wave, the displacement is orthogonal to our direction of propagation. So as you see this wave going through, you can see this block is being deformed in the shear direction, but there's actually no volume changes. And that's going to be sensitive to our shear modulus. So we can actually get the solution for these P and S waves out of our wave equation. But the first thing we're going to do is we're going to simplify this a bit. And we're going to assume that we have an homogeneous medium. So there's no changes, there's no discontinuities. We assume that the gradients of lambda and the mu are zero. And that in that case, we can drop out these two terms here and simplify our equation a bit to this. And now we are going to split our displacement into two potentials, phi and psi. And so taking the gradient of phi plus the curl of psi together gives us our displacement. And phi is a scalar potential, and it's scalar, and it has no curl, so there's no orthogonal motions. And psi is a vector potential, and it has no divergence. So really, this is splitting up our displacement field into our P waves and into our S waves. This is a different, using this vector relationship, we get that the Laplace of the psi, so the second derivatives, is the same as the divergence of U. So we're looking at our P wave, our volume changes that are happening. And then the Laplace of psi is given by the curl of U. So we're looking at our shear displacement in the psi. So if we fill in, so now we're going to fill in that U is equal to this in the wave equation. And we're going to use our favorite vector identity again and move this around. And we get this equation. So we have, I put phi, all the phi terms on the left-hand side and all the psi terms on the right-hand side. And now we can say, well, one solution to this equation is if both sides are zero. So we split, this side can be zero, that side can be zero, and we get two separate equations for phi, which is a scalar, and psi, which is a vector. And I've rearranged the moduli terms into here. And this one I've called alpha, which you can see defined over here. And you might recognize this as the p-wave velocity. And in this one, we have beta, which is the square root of mu over rho, which you might recognize as the shear wave velocity. And so to show a solution to one of these equations, so one solution for this is a plane wave that is propagating. So here you can see the planes of the wave as it's propagating in this direction. So this is given by A as an amplitude, and here the phase is coherent in time and space given by the frequency and the wave number. Or here is shown this is a function of distance plus some velocity over time, so your wave comes back at a regular interval. And so in this case, so I'm looking at the equations for P waves here, our velocity is alpha, and it's equal to frequency over the wave number. So this is just to show how you get to P and S waves out of the wave equation. And any questions about that? And you can do a similar thing for the S waves, which is a vector solution. Okay, so here's a little movie of our P and S waves propagating through the Earth. The P wave is here in orange. It's the faster wave. It goes through the core. And since the outer core doesn't have a shear modulus, right, all our S waves are reflecting off of it. You can see it quickly becomes quite complicated. There's many waves scattering in many, many different directions. There are other waves. So there are surface waves that are expanding across the surface. And there are normal modes, which are longer periods vibrations of the Earth. And so Jessica will cover these two types of waves in the final seismology lecture. So I'll be mostly ignoring them. And they all have different periods or frequency sensitivity. So in today's lecture, we'll be mostly looking in this regime. So we're looking at from periods from 1 to maybe tens of seconds. Surface waves are longer periods, and normal modes are the longest periods. Yes? I can repeat your question.
So I understand that P waves are faster than S waves, but is that a purely observed phenomena, or can you derive that from the wave equation?
Well, it's because the kappa is much larger than the shear modulus.
Okay.
So, I mean, you can imagine. I mean, we can do a little experiment here, which I do with... Yeah, you wouldn't have a shear modulus. Yeah. Because there's 2 mu as well. Yeah. If lambda is zero, it would be faster as well. Although, it's a tough one to think about. But experiment we do with kids is you line them up, and if you push the person in front of you, and you push through, it goes really quickly. If you shear, you get a much slower wave already from that, from a human experiment. So the P wave is just an easier propagating, but it's a material property.
So just a little comment on that. The ratio of P wave to S wave velocity is often used as kind of a proxy for making inferences about the material. So the lowest VPVS ratio you can have clearly is the one where lambda equals zero, in which case VP is square root of 2 times faster than VS. And what is square root of 2? 1.4. So about 1.4. For typical crustal rocks, it's about square root of 3. So VP is usually about square root of 3 times VS. In the mantle, the VPVS ratio is something like 1.8, 1.9, I guess, times the VS. But this can be used. So if you enter a region where you have partial melt, the VP VS ratio can approach like 2 or In the very shallow subsurface, it can be well above 2. So this is kind of what, like, you can, crustal composition also you can infer. So the lowest, like a quartzite would be 1.5, which is pretty much the lowest VPVS ratio crustal rocks, but a typical granite would be more like 1.7. So this is kind of like a big, I guess experimentalists measure this stuff for.
Yeah. So when we talk about the period, it's related to the wavelength of a wave, which is the velocity times the period. And so it's related to the size of the structures that our wave can resolve. So in these different waves, we'll have different resolutions to different size structures. At these shorter periods or higher frequencies, these are being used in reflection seismology or active source seismology to look at the shallowest kilometers. And since we like to talk about numbers that are above 1, you can recognize global seismologists by talking about periods, while exploration seismologists talk in frequencies. So a couple more like things about how body waves travel through the Earth, and a couple more characteristics that are important for us seismologists, and some definitions that we work with. So we talk both about a wave front, which is the propagating front of the wave, and a seismic ray, which is kind of the path that one bit of wavefront has taken between the earthquake and a receiver. So in this video, you saw both the wavefronts in orange, and in yellow, you see a drawing of different ray paths for the P and the S waves as they travel through the Earth. We also have defined 3 different components in our wave framework. So we have the P component, which is parallel to the seismic wave propagation. So this is where the displacement of the P wave is. But then the S wave, we define 2 orthogonal components, where one displacement is in the plane between the earthquake and the receiver, while the other displacement, SH, is orthogonal to that. So if I have a wave diving down and coming back up, the SH wave is always an horizontal displacement. That's where the kind of H comes from. While the SV wave is more horizontal as I go down, but then the SV, at the turning point of the wave, my SV is vertical. And then it turns again as I go up. And we may kind of make this distinction because in the Earth, we have a lot of horizontal boundaries. And when the wave interacts with a horizontal boundary, we can get energy to convert between the P and the SV, like is happening at the core-mountain boundary. But our SH is separated from that. It cannot convert energy unless our like boundaries tipping and stuff. But assuming surfaces are horizontal, there's no conversion of energy between the two. And a little bit of Snell's law. So when a wave hits a boundary, it has an incoming angle. And so this could be, for example, a reflection on the core mount of boundary of an S wave. And the outgoing reflective angle is the same. When a wave is refracted, the angle changes at the boundary. And that depends on the 2 velocities on both sides. And I remember Snell's law, which tells you that the sine of a wave over the velocity in the top medium is the same as the sine of the angle over the velocity in the bottom medium. And that comes from the interaction of the wavefront at the medium. So here I've drawn an incoming ray path, and these lines are the wavefront continuing. And these are the wavefronts continuing in the bottom medium, which has a faster velocity. And so along the interface, these wavefronts align up. So we're interfering correctly along the interface. And if you look at the velocity of this wave along the interface, or we get the sine over the velocity, is kind of the slowness of the wave along our interface. So slowness is 1 over the velocity. That needs to be the same on both sides of this interface. And so this counts for any interface that my wave travels through, right? So this is always the same. And we call this a P. This is the ray parameter. And the rate parameter describes a lot about how my wave travels through the Earth, because I know the horizontal slowness, or one over the velocity, is the same everywhere, and it's the same at every interface. So here this is shown in a slightly different way. So here is my slowness vector. So this is 1 over the velocity, wave number over the velocity. And I can decompose it into the horizontal slowness over here, my p, and the vertical slowness, eta here, which is the cosine of the angle over alpha. And so this slowness remains the same everywhere along my ray path, and the vertical slowness is the one that is changing as I'm changing, as the velocity is changing in the Earth. Constant varies along ray path. And there's another nice attribute to that, and that is that we can measure the horizontal slowness at the surface. If we have an earthquake happening and we have an array of stations with distance, and we can measure the travel time of our arriving wave everywhere along this ray path, we can now take the gradient of the travel time between two stations, and we get our horizontal slowness, or our horizontal inverse velocity, along the surface. And so if we've done that between two stations, we are measuring a ray parameter, and we already know a lot about how our wave has traveled through the Earth, or what the horizontal slowness of this wave has been all along its ray path. And so the ray parameter is something you can measure, mostly if you have more than one seismic station, and it's the tangent to the travel time curve. And so here you see a typical travel time curve, and you can see that my gradient is decreasing with distance away from the earthquake. So my gradient, and so my horizontal slowness, is decreasing with distance away from the earthquake. And that makes sense that my slowness is decreasing, because it means that my average velocity of this wave is increasing. And that's because my ray has gone deeper, and so it's seen faster velocities overall, and it's arriving at the stations quicker. I've shown you this was in a kind of a flat Earth approximation. But when we talk about global seismology, we have to think about the Earth actually being a sphere. And so now it's not my slowness in second per kilometer that's constant, but it's second per radians, or my angular slowness, that is constant for a ray. And so we get this conversion factor from kilometer to radians in our equation for the ray parameter, or in our Snell's law. So now at any place, we also need to take the radius of that interface to the center of the Earth into our equation, and that's the parameter that remains constant along my ray path in a spherical Earth. And one nice thing that we can do with that is think about what is actually happening at the turning point of the ray. So at the turning point of a ray, my sine I is now 90 degrees, or pi over 2, which is 1. And so at that point where my ray turns, the ray parameter is equal to the radius at the turning point over the velocity at the turning point. And so now we can already think about something that if we measure all these ray parameters, we know something about the velocity at the depth. Of course, we don't necessarily know where our ray is turning, because where a ray turns depends on the velocity model. But we have a solvable problem here that we know the relationships between the two. As long as we have enough measurements at many, many different distances, we can slowly try to build a 1D velocity model, figuring out where our rays turn and what the velocities at our turning points are. And we built our roughly 1D velocity model increase with velocity and depth. So here's our example of a couple of these 1D models for the entire Earth, increase of VP, VS, density across the mantle, the outer core, and the inner core. And here's a zoom in on the mantle, where we have these little jumps in velocity in the mantle transition zone. And this is our kind of 1D background Earth model, which is telling us most about how the rays propagate, although obviously the rays are also affected by smaller scale velocity factors. variations that are happening in the Earth. When a wave hits a boundary, it's not only reflecting and refracting, but it also has this conversion of energy between the P and the S wave. So here's a P wave exciting the boundary, and then the boundary excites S waves also in both directions. And the angles at which these reflect and refract depend on the shear velocities in the two different mediums. And so this, again, this is conversion for a purely horizontal boundary. This is conversion from the P wave to the SV energy. While my SA, it's just nicely, it's moving orthogonal to my slides here, and then it reflects and refracts on its own as an independent system. And these are nice waves to look at. It's nice to look at waves that have been converted or waves that have been reflected, because they're sensitive to the impedance contrast across this boundary. The amplitudes are sensitive to that. They're sensitive to the impedance, which is the velocity times the density. And so looking at the amplitudes of these waves can tell us something about the velocity jump and the density jumps that is happening at these discontinuities. And we're interested in discontinuities in Earth at mantle transition zone, at the core mantle boundary. It tells us about compositional jumps or about phase changes that are happening. So here's a bit of nomenclature about the body waves. So you've probably seen these long winded names for different body waves. So what seismologists do is just for every bit of path of the ray path is they add another letter to it. So a P is just a regular bit of P wave in the mantle, and S is a bit of S wave in the mantle. But then we use a K when it's a P wave in the outer core, a capital I for a P wave in the inner core, a capital J for an S wave in the inner core. So we can add these together. So if we have a wave that goes all the way through the Earth, it becomes a PKIKP. If that wave reflects off the surface here and goes all the way back and gets picked up here, you have a PKIKP, PKIKP wave. So you can keep going with this. There are waves that go into the core and then reflect off the bottom of the core mantle boundary. So an example here is an S, K, K, S wave. But that one can also bounce multiple times, so you can get an S, K, 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 S wave. Although with every reflection or refraction or whatever, you're losing energy, so they become more and more difficult to observe. A reflection at the surface, you also just repeat the letter, so you get a P, a PP, a PPP. When you get a reflection off the core mantle boundary, we put a C in, so you get an SCS here, or a PCP wave. A reflection of the inner core boundary is a little I. Reflection of a MOO is an M. And then we have this little P and S phases, and these are really for waves that have traveled up to the surface first from the earthquake, and then reflected off the surface and then continued. So you have, let me see if there's an example here. I don't think there's an example here. But these are called depth phases. And if the earthquake is shallow, they arrive just after the main P wave. So after main P wave, you have a little P wave, or you have a little S P wave. But if the earthquake is deep, they arrive much later. Yeah, so we'll see some examples of all of these waves. Not all of these waves. Some of these waves later. One thing seismologists do is when you have a seismic station, it is installed with one component in the north direction and one component in the east direction. And that's not necessarily the framework we want to think about for our waves coming from the earthquake. So one of the first things we tend to do is take these two horizontal components and rotate them into one direction, which is in the direction of the earthquake, which we call the radial component, and one direction that is 90 degrees to that, and was a transverse component. And this gives us a relationship to our wave propagation wave framework, where we have these P, SV, and SH waves. And now we see the P and SV components still be arriving on the radial component, so they're in the direction of the earthquake, and on the vertical component, while our SH waves will be arriving on the transverse component. And so here's an example of a seismogram. Here's a north-south, an east-west, and a vertical one. And here are the two rotated components of radial and transverse. And so on these components, we see all these different phases arriving. And you can see if it's a radial and a transverse, We have cleaned it up a bit more. Our SKS and SKKS components, so these are waves that have traveled through the outer core, so they've gone from an S wave to a P wave and then back to an S wave. When they went back from P to S, they were only going to be SV energy, so we expect them to be mostly on the radio component. And our S, well, S diffracted is a bit of an exception. S diffracted, the diff I haven't explained, an S diffracted wave is a wave that goes down and it diffracts on the core mantle boundary and then comes up again. And because it's traveling along the core mantle boundary, the SV component is constantly coupling with the core and causing P waves and losing energy, and the SH component can propagate much better and arrive much more clearly.
So is there other information that goes into determining that that's like an SKKS wave, or is it just like an interpretation of a plot like this, that you know that SKKS is that peak?
Yeah. No. Yeah. If you're a little bit of a seismologist, you just look at that and you're like, yeah, that looks like an SKKS. No, it doesn't work like that. So we have a good sense of the 1D Earth model, as I mentioned. So as a seismologist, when you interpret this plot, is what you first do is you compute the predicted travel time for your different phases, and you put that on your seismogram so you can see which peak might relate to a phase that you're interpreting.
So basically, you have an underlying model of the Earth that you use to interpret.
Yeah, and that's because we know the 1D model fairly well to be able to find these phases. But then the next step is that we're interested in the differences from the 1D model we're interested in when they don't exactly arrive at the time that we expect.
And which 1D model do you use, PREM, or is it any other model that is, I don't know, more widely used nowadays?
Some of these choices depend on where you're working on. So, for example, PREM is a model that has included normal modes. While AK135, for example, is a very much body wave model. And so for some like body waves in the outer core, AK135 is better. But it depends on the problem. PREM has a discontinuity at 220, so depending on what problem you work on, that might be a problem or not. Yeah, so there's some choices to make. And for a lot of problems, it doesn't matter.
Just a quick comment on what Scott was asking. So sometimes you see a phase and it's really not clear what it might be, because there is no predicted arrival at that time. In that case, what's really helpful is actually having like a small array, so having multiple seismometers near each other, because then you can measure the rate parameter, like Sana said. So in other words, you can measure how long it takes for the wave to go from one station to the one near it, which allows you to determine
the rate parameter,
and then you know the exact path that the wave took, so you can essentially backtrack it.
Thank you, Ved. So contemplations of a body wave seismologist. So I thought I would go over a little bit what like a study of a body wave seismology looks like, partially in case if you want to do a mini study during CIDR, or what kind of things. First, talk about what kind of things we're looking for. So we're looking for waves that aren't arriving at the time that we thought they were arriving. So maybe we have a travel time shift between what we predicted as our wave arrival versus what we are observing. And in that case, we can interpret that there is some velocity model anywhere along our ray path, or maybe that the ray path that we think the wave took is incorrect. Our wave has actually traveled a different path because our 1D velocity model, for example, is wrong. Our background assumption was wrong. Or a wave has a different amplitude than the wave that we predicted. And in this case, it can have many reasons. We could have been wrong about the amount of radiated energy from the earthquake in this direction. There can be focusing and defocusing effects due to anomalies. Energy can be scattered away, both at discontinuities or by smaller scatterers, heterogeneity in the material. Or there can be anelasticity. I don't know why that got changed in. So there's many different possibilities. And so you can see if you're looking at one of these observations, if I have one observation of a travel time difference or one observation of amplitude difference, there's nothing really I can say about that. I don't know where my anomaly is coming from. And so for a lot of these problems, what we want to do is combine lots and lots of observations, lots and lots of measurements. Maybe we also want to combine measurements at different frequencies to say something about the Earth. And this is something that Ved will be talking about, is how can I combine lots and lots of different observations in an inverse problem to measure, say, velocity variations within the Earth and build maps like this of a slab going down. But there's also signals in a wave that can't necessarily be included in these kind of inverse problems. And there are smaller scale waveform complexities that we see in a wave that we want to use. So for example, here I drew a wave, and before the wave, we see a little wave arrival, and after the wave, we see a little wave arrival. And these were not predicted waves that we thought were happening. So we have a signal here coming from somewhere that we don't know. And from these waves, we want to measure their differential time, or their amplitudes, or their frequency content to figure out where these waves are coming from. One example of such waves that have helped us find out that there's a 410 discontinuity and a 660 discontinuity are triplications. And this is one type of multipathing. This is where at a given distance, and for the mountain transition zone, this happens from about 15 degrees to 30 degrees from the earthquake, we see around the arrival that we expect, we actually see two or three different arrivals happening at one single distance. And that's because we have got an arrival that has turned just above the discontinuity. But then because there's a sharp velocity increase, we also have an arrival that has actually gone down through the velocity increase and then turned up more sharply and also arrives at the same station. Okay, so these are small and they're very close in time, different arrivals that have actually had slightly different paths because there was a sharp increase in velocity. So here I've shown arrivals with time, but here I've shown the different ray parameters of the arrivals as a function of distance. There's other ways of multipathing, so that was kind of for if we have a horizontal boundary seismic discontinuity, but we can also have a velocity anomaly somewhere. And then between our earthquake and the receiver, there might have been a wave path that has gone outside of the velocity anomaly, and one that's arriving closely at the same time that has gone through the velocity anomaly. And now suddenly, say I have two P waves arrival, and they don't have like a unique path that they've taken. And sometimes there's these guided waves. So for example, one phase goes directly up, and then one phase has gone through the slab and has then come up to my receiver function, to my receiver. And these waves are interested in itself. Often when we interpret them, we use the tomographic model to guide us of like, where might these secondary waves come from? And if we know there's a slab there, for example, we can model if these can have been guided waves. So the tomographic model kind of guides us to the like vague velocity anomalies that are there. But seeing waves like this can help us to actually model the velocity anomalies that are actually in these anomalies, because the tomography will have probably underestimated the velocity anomalies. And then we want to target all of these boundaries, for example, with reflected phases. These don't get included. Yes?
When What's the minimal signal you need to be able to measure?
I will talk about this in a second, how we can stack data when our signals are below the noise. So as I mentioned, when we have a reflection of a boundary, it is sensitive to the velocity. The amplitude of this is sensitive to the velocity and the density contrast across a boundary. And so that's interesting for the core mantle boundary when we're looking at a compositional change, or in the mantle transition zone where we're looking at phase changes. The frequency content of these waves give sensitivity to the sharpness of the boundary. So how is my discontinuity jump over a couple kilometers, or does it change over tens of kilometers? And then we would like to know the topography on, say, the core mantle boundary, or the topography on phase transitions, because that tells us something about the dynamics that is ongoing there. It tells us something about temperature or compositional variations that are ongoing. And to do that, we need to measure the travel times of these waves to see if they actually arrive where they are. It's a little bit tricky because we both want to measure the topography, say, on one of these boundaries, but there's also lots of material that these waves travel through that could have velocity variations that we're then mapping into the topography. So this is where you need to know the velocities to map the topography, and it's a circular problem. The other way to kind of go around this is that you need a reference phase. So for example, here is a wave that reflects off the core mantle boundary, a PCP wave, and then there's a P wave that is gone right through above. And so looking at the difference in travel time between these two waves will give much more sensitivity to the topography on the boundary, since their paths everywhere else are kind of similar. So seismologists are always desperately looking for the right reference phase to kind of correct for the path and to be able to focus on the area that they're trying to target in the deep earth. So besides reflective phases, there's the convergent phases. So here's an example, is a P wave that goes directly up to my station, and then there's energy that hits the 410 and converts to an S wave, and energy that hits the 660 and converts to an S wave. So because the shear wave velocity is slower, they arrive later. So here's the P wave arrival, and here are converted. So in this example, they're MOO and LAB conversions instead of mantle transition zone ones. You can also have the opposite, so you have an S wave, and you have waves that have converted from S to P, and so they're faster, and they arrive before the S wave. And so these kind of observations, so these are visible here, the conversions from the 410 and 660 will not be visible in an individual seismogram. And so this is where we have to stack data together to see anything. I will show a bit more about that.
But how do they convert, or why do they convert?
Okay, so that's so when a P wave is hitting the boundary, the boundary itself is emitting the S waves. So you have a pressure wave hitting this horizontal thing, and then that boundary emits the shear waves in both directions. Then there is a scattering of waves. So often we don't see a very sharp arrival of a waveform, but we see all this slightly later arrivals that is scattered by the heterogeneity in the Earth. So if we just look at tomographic models, we might think that the Earth is some smooth variations of redite and blueite. Those are the two different rocks that are down there. But then if you look at the higher frequency scattering, you see that there are smaller scale variations in the Earth of unmixed materials. And that is kind of the materials we're interested in for this CIDR, because it represents the geochemical variations that are in the Earth. And so after waves, we kind of see this trailing of scattered energy that we call coda. And the wavelength of this scattered is sensitive to the sizes of the heterogeneity. We might be able to measure where this scattered energy is coming from, so where heterogeneity might be present, or what the amplitudes are of the scattered waves, representing what the velocity variations of the heterogeneity is. Sometimes we can map out individual scatterers, where they're coming from. Sometimes we're looking at the statistical properties of scatterers. We're actually quite lucky in the Earth. The scattering is actually quite low if you, for example, compare it to the Moon, where you get a fully scattered wave train. So how do you start with, as a body wave seismologist, you might want to target a specific area in the Earth, but you might be constrained by where there's earthquakes and where there's receivers that can actually target your area. So for example, here's a density map of pierce points at 660 kilometers that are available in a single database. Here is an example of diffracted paths over the Pacific. So this is mostly dense due to the transportable array in the US and earthquakes over here. So in a good seismology, you have a hypothesis, you find the phases you can use, the geometry you can use, and you find a reference phase. Or you've seen this new array is out there, you have a specific method that you have set up, and you go look at that set of data and you'll find something interesting as well. So we're not always hypothesis driven, but in most data sets there's something interesting there that you can then look at. Basically you look at what waves aren't like I expected them to be. Or if you don't have seismic stations there, you actually go out to install the seismic station. So some real seismologists who are here, Maureen Long is here, Neela Krisa is here, actually go out and get their hands dirty. This is Maureen thinking she has a faster way to figure out the secrets of the deep earth. Some of us just download the data from a database. So I apologize to the mineral physicists in the room. This is slightly painful. We just set a script running and we download the data that is usable for us. And so one example database is the IRIS database where you can select events and download data. And then pretty much, well, the first thing you do is remove the instrument response. So this is how your seismic instrument has reacted to the Earth's movement. You don't want that bias in there. You rotate your north and east components to the radio and transverse. You predict the arrival times for the phases of interest so you can actually find them in your seismogram. Maybe you create some synthetic seismograms that you can compare them to so you see how good or bad your waveforms are. And then you might apply some sort of automated quality control or manual quality control. So this is me doing manual control, going yes, yes, no, yes, yes, no. This is where you get keen to get undergraduates involved in your research. So this is a little bit of software highlights. So one Python library that you can use to do all of these things is OpsFi. So it handles downloading, handles removing instrument response. There's lots of signal processing routines already in there and plotting functions. And one of our seismology practicals will be based on this. You might want to choose the frequency band we're looking in. So the frequency bands depends on the resolution or the size of the anomalies that you can be looking at. You might want to deconvolve the source out. So if you can assume that you know what the source looks like, you can deconvolve that out of your trace and you just get little pulses for the different arrivals. You might want to do that because you cannot see your individual arrivals. And if you want to stack different seismograms from different sources together, you want to take out that source component so you don't stack all of those together. One way to do that for a receiver function, and so this is a MATLAB GUI by Megan Miller, who's here, and Rob Porritt, and you can download and process and stack receiver functions in MATLAB as a graphical user interface. So stacking you can do in different ways. So when you cannot see your individual phases, but you're expecting them, you might have to use an array of stations that you stack together. So here's an example of one earthquake and a set of stations that you can use together to try to get your signal above the noise levels. Or you can stack over different earthquakes towards one station or different earthquakes and multiple stations. So if we assume at a distance that our plane wave is coming in at the different stations, we can now find the horizontal slowness of this wave coming across our stations. So what you do is you try different horizontal slownesses and you shift and you stack your seismograms together, assuming different horizontal slownesses sweeping across the array. And then you can see where the energy comes in most coherently at which slowness. So here we have time, here we have slowness, and here we see peaks of our different arrivals coming in at a specific slowness. Or we can question, we want to know which direction is a wave coming from. Is it actually coming from the direction of the earthquake, what we expect, or is it coming from a different direction? And so now I assume my plane wave is coming from different directions across my array, which is here we're looking from above at this. So we have a wavefront coming across. And I see for which back azimuth my energy is stacking most coherently across the array. And so we stack it together. And then you might see that maybe your energy isn't coming from the earthquake, but has been scattered out of the plane. Or we can do both. So this is actually a slowness back azimuth stack. So here you're seeing an energy arriving at a specific, so slowness here is increasing away from the center, and back azimuth is over here from north. And so you can see the little peaks and a bigger peak here of a wave coming in at a specific slowness and back azimuth towards this array. So with seismic arrays, we can look at smaller arrivals, but we can also get more information about the arrivals, like the direction and their slownesses. Okay, let's go to some cool studies. We have about 50 minutes. So the studies that I'm showing here are somewhat biased to the seismologists that are currently in the room or that are arriving soon here. And so you will see whenever there's a seismologist who's going to be at CIDR, I've given them a first name. I'm sorry, I'm also not covering all the seismologists in the room, because not everybody is a body wave seismologist. So this is a study by Jessica Irving, who will be arriving later. And so we're starting in the inner core and we're going upwards. And here we're looking at the differences between a wave that has gone through just the outer core and arrives here, and the wave that has gone through the inner core. And these are two different seismograms. The dashed lines here is where we predict our arrivals to be. You can't see the dashed line, or you can barely see the dashed line for the blue arrival here. This is our PKP, which has gone through the outer core because it's arriving exactly like we expect. But then when we look at the wave that has gone through the inner core, we see that on this seismogram, that wave is somewhat delayed, while on this seismogram, that wave is arriving early. And the differences between these two seismograms is that this orientation is roughly equatorial, and this orientation is roughly polar. So we're seeing a wave that is traveling roughly polar through the inner core arrive faster than a wave that is traveling equatorial. And this is very weird. And we can look at a lot of data, and we can characterize them by the angle of their propagation through the inner core with the rotational axis. Okay, so if this angle is 0, it's very polar, and if this angle is 90 degrees, it's very equatorial. And if we collect a lot of data like that, so they're colored here, so anything with polar records are blue here, and equatorial records are yellow. And we've collected them here with turning longitude on Earth. And you can see that the equatorial records are all quite normal. They all scatter roughly around 0. But then we have this group of records which are quite polar. And they're also mainly in one of our hemispheres. So in the Western hemispheres, all of these are about 4 seconds faster. And in the Eastern hemisphere, they're average. Don't ask me why. So our inner core has hemispherical, has a different velocity for polar paths. I guess I'm talking about anisotropy here, which Maureen will cover more. This is a study by Lauren Westlake, who will also arrive after study. And here we're looking at waves that have gone, comparing waves that have reflected off the inner core versus waves that have just dipped into the inner core and gone up. So they're very sensitive to the top layer of the inner core down to a depth of 100 kilometers into the inner core. And she has looked at the travel time differences between these. And here they're also organized by longitude. And you see we have one hemisphere which is fast and one hemisphere which is slow in velocities at the top of the inner core. And we don't know why this is. I'm not going to answer any questions here. I'm just showing seismic observations. So if you look from above, you kind of see this. So this is a North Pole view of all of these phases. So the red and the blue are travel times, the differences of about 1 to 2 seconds. And this is a look from the South Pole. So maybe they're also not totally two hemispheres. There might just be a chunk of separate velocities here. It's not totally 180 degrees. It's also a bit random that they divide up kind of roughly with how we humans think about west and east, so we can comfortably talk about western hemisphere and eastern hemisphere, but that's probably just luck. Okay, let's move to the outer core. So these are waves that are travel through the outer core and then bounce off of the bottom of the inner core as they travel through. So we have our SKKS wave, which only has one bounce. The SKKK wave, which has 2 bounces. And so we have an increased number of bounces. And the more bounces it has, the more sensitive it is to the uppermost layer of the outer core. So people have been looking at these waves for a long time to look at if there is an anomalous layer at the top of the outer core, which could affect like our heat budget going across through the core mantle boundary, et cetera. And so here are observations. So here, S3KS just means there's 3Ks, or S4KS means there's 4Ks. And so these are increased number of bounces of observation. So here you can see some real seismograms, and here you can see some synthetic seismograms looking much nicer. And so people have looked at these differential times to see if there's an anomalous velocity here. And here you can see observations made, I should say these actual, the measurement observations are from a Helfrich and Kanishima paper made long ago, which are which are zero here. And people have looked at these and have inferred there's a slow seismic velocity layer at the top of the outer core in reference to PREM. And PREM, as I mentioned, is heavily weighted by normal modes, and these body waves showed something different. So there was like, oh, there's an anomalous layer up here. I'm kind of highlighting this work because this is work we started at CIDR 2 years ago, and we managed to publish it 2 weeks ago. So it has just come out. But and we developed a new model for the outer core, different from PREM, but a new 1D model, and it fits the body waves. We only use normal modes, but it fits these body waves observations in green here. So they're closer to zero than any of the other 1D body wave models that I showed here. So it's PREM, AK135, YASP91. And it separately fits the body waves better than all of these other models, which might mean that there is no seismically visible anomalous layer, which doesn't mean there's no anomalous layer. Let's jump to the mantle sign. So Sujo already highlighted these large low shear velocity provinces, which are these big red blobs that we see at the bottom of the lower mantle in tomographic models. But then tomographic models see everything a bit more smoothly, so it's interesting to look at these with higher frequency body waves so we can see actually how sharp these boundaries are. So here's one example with that using S-diffracted waves that travel along the core mantle boundary. This is a wave in the Fiji area. This is where the waves travel onto the core mantle boundary. This is where they come up to this array in southern Africa. And they are sensitive to this large low shear velocity boundary here. And this is showing an example of multipathing. So here are the waves actually going from south to north across here. And so S-diff, S-diff, S-diff. And suddenly when you go to north here, we see a sudden jump in our waves, and they're delayed by about 8 seconds. So this sudden jump is across the boundary of the LLSVPs and suggests the boundary is much sharper than we see in these tomographic models. And also around this boundary, we have this little postcurse here. We have two waves arriving at the specific seismic station. So this is interpreted to be one wave that has traveled around outside of the LSVP arriving earlier, and one wave that has traveled through the LSVP arriving. And so we have two different paths arriving at the same station. You can also see these boundaries of the LSVPs in P waves. This is a study by Dan Frost. And he looked at the boundary of over here of the Pacific LSVP. And on the north here, beneath Hawaii of the Pacific LSVP. And you can see the travel time anomalies of this cross-section here, going from slow to fast, and over here from B prime to B, going from B over here to B prime, going from slow to fast. You see the boundary on this end is much steeper than the boundary up here. And so, I mean, we've always called these things large, low shear velocity provinces, but really we can drop the shear because we also they could just be large, low velocity provinces. Or really, we just need a different name for them. But I think I've been wanting that every CIDR, and maybe it's a goal for this CIDR. So here's another example of multipathing of S-diff wave. And this is also where a little bit of luck comes in. This is an earthquake I looked at to look at the boundary of this LLSVP here beneath Hawaii. And so this is an earthquake here in New Ireland region, becomes sensitive to the core mantle boundary here, and comes up here to the transportable array. And this is what I expect in my synthetics to see in the S-diffracted wave. But really, what you see here when you go from north to south is you see the S-diffracted wave almost disappear. And 30 seconds later, this wave here pops up. And it's here it's 30 seconds delayed, up to here it's 50 seconds delayed. So it's a very, very strong signal. And it was kind of random that I ran into that. But if you use your seismic array and you figure out actually the direction where this energy is coming from, this postcurse energy, you can see that it comes from a focal point at the core mantle boundary. And so all of this energy must have been focused in a focal point and scattered away. And that can be done by a very, very, very slow anomalous patch called the ultra-low velocity zone, which Sujo also talks, spoke about. And the other thing about this observation is that it's very frequency dependent. So we see this happening, this disappearance and this post-cursor when we look from 10 to 20 second periods. But if we go to longer periods, 30 to 50 seconds, we really don't see much of a signal. We see a little bit of a travel time delay maybe. And these are the frequencies that are used in tomographic models. And so tomographic models cannot find these smaller scaled, very strong anomalies. So you need to use higher frequency body waves, more targeted studies to, for example, map ultra-low velocity zones. Scatterers. We actually have, sorry, I'm missing Dan's name here. So Dan, this is studied by Dan Frost. We actually have a lot of people here that have worked on scattering, and Nick is here, and Lauren has worked on scattering, which is great because this is relates to the geochemical anomalies and the topic of this. And so one type of looking at scatterers, so there's a wave here that has gone through the entire core, has bounced off the core-mantle boundary and gone through. But maybe later there are waves arriving that have actually scattered from an anomaly in the mantle and then have come back and be picked up by a station. So you're looking at smaller scale energy of arrivals that we not necessarily predict in the first place if we just had a simple 1D model. And you need arrays to look at this. So you can look at the time slowness of these different peaks, or these different amplitude peaks or different scatterers, or you can look at their back azimuth and slowness and try to back project where these scatterers are coming from. Here's a different type of PKP wave, where the scatterers can either come from where, if you're just looking at the lower mantle, they come from the entry or the exit points into the core mantle boundary. So this is a study by Nick, who's here. And so you're looking at precursor energy here, and you figure out which back azimuth and time they're coming from. So slowness, here's a slowness back azimuth stack, and the different amplitudes. So these stacks look very different in different studies, but they're often the same thing. Here are actually different maps. So Lauren Wasek also has a study using PKP precursors. Here are some of their different maps of where they've located the scatterers. Sometimes it's not clear if they're from the entry or the exit point where these scatterers are coming from. I would say a bit of an open question, and maybe a question for the decider having all these people in the room, is are they actually seeing the same things? Are these things at similar wavelengths? And by combining these data sets, can we know better where these scatterers are coming from? It's not totally clear if they're coming from mainly the boundaries of the LLSVPs or mainly from slab regions or non-slab regions. And what these might be are, is this actually subducted crust and such that we're looking at? 5 more minutes. So I'm sorry I'm going a bit quick, but I just want to show a couple of these different examples. These are SS precursors, so this is one way to look at the mantle transition zone. So these are underside bounces on the 410 and the 660, and they arrive before the SS wave. So my SS wave is the one that bounces off the surface and then comes to a receiver. Here are synthetic waves. So here's my synthetic arrival SS, so we're looking at long distances. We're over 140 degrees away from our earthquake. And then before that, we expect the 410 reflections and the 660 reflections. And here is what the real data looks like. So it's really hard to see the 410 here. It's also quite hard to see the 660 here. So you see examples here of where you have to combine different data sets to actually see what is happening here. And so one thing you can then try to do with that is map the topography of the 410 and the 660. This is a study by Christine Hauser, who will be coming here. And here you see places in the Pacific, for example, where the 410 is deeper and the 660 is shallower. And in a simple mantle transition zone interpretation, that means it's a hot anomaly. The thinning of the mantle transition zone is related to hotter temperatures. That is when you're assuming there's no compositional variations that are messing up your signal. And maybe here you also see a location where the 660 is very deep, or maybe slams are affecting the 660. So the other thing you can look at is just take the difference between the two and look at the transition zone thickness. And so you see thinning across here and then you see thickening over here. And then you can compare that to the shear wave velocities that we see in tomographic models to interpret that. In these SS precursors, So here we're looking at a slowness time stack again. This is our main SS arrival, the S410S, S660S. You can also find scatterers before that, which are due to scatterers in the mid-mantle. And this is a study Lauren Wasek mapped out. And the scatterers seem to be at the top of the lower mantle, at least where that's what you're sensitive to here. You see them in different regions, both at LSVPs and in subduction zone areas. There was a group at CIDR who were working on these kind of things. And I think Nila came up with a better name for these anomalies, is MIMOSAS, mid-mantle observed seismic anomalies. So I'm just repeating that to see if it catches on in this study. I want to show some examples of guided waves. So we're again a bit shallower here. So here are waves. This is across an array in Morocco. And these are waves that have gone up through S waves from a deep earthquake here in Spain that have gone up through this slow anomaly here. And you can see in the waveforms that there are multiple delayed phases arriving. And this is an example of a synthetic of such a slow anomaly. The main phase is arriving, and you can get different postcursors due to multipathing, due to a wave going through the slow anomaly and one wave going outside of the slow anomaly. And so these can give us a better resolution on what the actual delay is in such an anomaly. This deep Spain event, this is a deep earthquake in Spain that happened in 2010, which actually has been used in a lot of deep earth research. This one is sensitive to the hemispherical boundary in the core, and it has also mapped out anomalies at the core mantle boundary. So it's a much overused earthquake. And here's a study of a more guided wave in a subducting slab. So this is across Japan, looking at earthquake where you have a direct P wave going up to the stations, and you have delayed energy that is arriving up at the station. So here's our direct P wave as a function of time and distance in kilometers now instead of degrees, because we're looking so locally. And these are the scattered waves that are arriving delayed. And you might think, okay, well, I might believe you. I don't know if this is scattered waves. But this is filtered above 1 hertz. And if we filter this to much higher frequencies, you can now see a much more convincing picture. So we don't see the main P wave anymore, but we see these scattered high-frequency waves that are arriving later that have gone through the slab. I'm so amazed I made it to the end of my 90-something slides. I'm sorry, guys. Are there any questions? Oh, yeah.
Where's the microphone?
Who's closest to a microphone?
So why does the moon has more like scattered seismic waves, and what do you think about Mars?
What I think about Mars?
So you mentioned, but also you mentioned that the moon has a more scattered seismic
wave. Yeah, because
wave.
It's a regolith. Yeah. Okay. Mars is.
How about Mars?
Same shallowly. Yeah. Okay. It's also a question for, I guess, Jessica works on Mars. Who else? Are there other people working on the Mars InSight mission here? Yeah, so wait a bit longer because the seismometer is arriving on Mars later this year. Yeah, Rita.
When you said you were correcting for the source, when you're deconvolving the source to get the how do you do that?
So there's different ways to do it. So deconvolution is also dividing the frequency spectrum from each other, so taking out your source component. There's also ways to do it in the time domain. I can show you. I have some couple other slides, but I can pull them up.
So you can formulate it as an inverse problem. So maybe I can put it as a slide in my.
You can also do that.
Just for you.
Very commonly done. Any other questions, Dominique?
Yeah. From the figure you show, you say there's a hemisphere in our inner core. So I wonder, what's the boundary between the west and the east?
So one of the boundaries is basically roughly at 0 degrees. It's slightly positive, more like 30. Yeah, but because it's somewhere close to zero, we comfortably talk about west and east. as they're separate. And so that's beneath Europe, and the other boundary is beneath the Pacific. Yeah. It varies a bit across studies as well, but there's some uncertainty on that. And so the Spain earthquake, right, it was very much located at the hemisphere, so it really improved the resolution on that boundary beneath Europe. Yeah.
So another question that reflects my naivety, but also
it's okay.
My,
you don't have to apologize my before interest. Asking questions.
I'm trying to understand two things. You set for your resolution of the ULVZ that you were lucky, and so what was lucky about the earthquake? It's more to understand the process. And the second is,
yes,
how small can you detect a zone, and how confident are you in your results?
Okay. Yeah, so the first question. So I was lucky because I was going to look, yeah, I was trying to look at the boundary. I was lucky that Barbara does not allow me to do an automated quality control, because any automated quality control would have thrown those hi, Barbara, on camera. You would have thrown out those traces because they don't look like the synthetics at all. So it was only that I looked at them by hand that it was like, what is this arrival that is 30 seconds later? Trying to figure out how that was behaving across the different traces. So while I was going to look at the sharpness of the LSP boundary there, I came across this signal. And actually, the presence of the ultra-low velocity zone there makes it very difficult to actually look at the LSP boundary there, because the signals are so complicated. So that's an argument for always doing manual quality control, because you might find things that haven't been seen before. And then your other question was, how confident? I am.
How small
I can go? Yeah. So the smaller, so that depends on the frequency of the wave. So I showed you the frequency sensitivity that this is about 10 to 20 seconds. So the hard thing of going below 10 seconds is that the seismograms also get noisier. You get the noises from the ocean seismos, and so that all becomes a bit more difficult. But if you want to see more about that, my student Lee over here will have a poster on that, trying to push it up to higher frequencies to see thinner zones.
Sorry guys, just a quick comment. So if you want to look at really, really tiny things, you have to go to high frequency, and Nick will talk about that, I guess, tomorrow.
Oh yeah, you're
in the afternoon.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be more on scatter.
Great, thanks, Sané. And now off for lunch.